Is uprising. Good morning and welcome to Uprising. President Obama has made the rare request of addressing a joint session of Congress to unveil his plan for job creation next week. Generally, the president makes such addresses for the annual State of the Union speech, but with continued high levels of unemployment in the face of corporate enrichment, there is growing public pressure to create jobs. While details of his plans are yet to be revealed, in an interview earlier this week, Obama hinted that it would involve a public works-type component. But the New York Times yesterday reported on an independent study on job creation month by month, which revealed that while job creation in the private sector slowed in August, the number of job cuts was highest among government employers. Because of right-wing pressure to reduce the government's deficit, it is likely that government job cuts will continue. Among those pushing for economic growth with little concern for jobs is the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. The watchdog group U.S. Chamber Watch is calling attention to the fact that the Chamber of Commerce offers corporate tax breaks and the annihilation of the social safety net as their only economic prescriptions. Worse, they have supported the passage of free trade bills and even openly encouraged outsourcing American jobs. Realizing that there are no real solutions coming from Washington or the private sector, city governments and grassroots organizations are pushing for local solutions. A new report by the Institute for Women's Policy Research finds that San Francisco has weathered the Great Recession better than its surrounding counties after mandating paid sick leave in 2007. San Francisco has actually created significantly more jobs and lost fewer jobs than its neighbors. Now, Denver, Colorado is considering a similar mandatory sick leave bill on its November ballot. Here in Los Angeles, hundreds of people attended a so-called kitchen table summit this week to pressure California Congressman Javier Becerra, one of the 12 members of Congress appointed to the super committee created by the recently passed deficit reduction debt ceiling bill. They want Becerra and his fellow lawmakers to focus on job creation rather than giving corporations and the wealthy more tax breaks. The U.S. Labor Department statistics reveal that 1 in 4 L.A. County workers are unemployed or underemployed. Joining me in studio this morning is Mike Garcia. He's the president of SEIU USWW, or United Service Workers West. He moderated this week's Kitchen Table Summit, organized by Good Jobs LA. Welcome to Uprising, Mike.
Thank you.
And on the phone with me is Christy Setzer. She's a spokesperson and senior advisor of U.S. Chamber Watch. Welcome, Christy.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Kevin Miller. He's a senior research associate with Institute for Women's Policy Research. Welcome, Kevin. So we're going to be focusing on job creation both at the national level and here locally. I'd like to begin locally with you, Mike. The Kitchen Table Summit, tell us more about it. What were some of the things that people said about what they'd like to see in Los Angeles regarding jobs?
Yes, there's several hundred people that showed up at the summit, and we invited Congressman Becerra. As you mentioned, he sits on the super committee that is going to be charged with putting forward a plan on how to fix our broken budget, federal budget. So for him to listen to the life stories of people that are suffering in Los Angeles County today, the huge unemployment. L.A. suffers from a 15% unemployment rate, higher than the state rate of 12%. And in some of the communities where we have been talking to people across Los Angeles, and we've knocked on 50,000 doors, the rates are even higher, as high as 40% in some of the most devastated and impoverished communities in Los Angeles. So people are hurting. They're losing their homes. They don't have money to pay rent. They have to make the hard choices of paying rent or putting food on the table for their children, et cetera. And people are actually homeless. And he had a heartbreaking story from a homeless woman who had recently lost her home and was out on living on the streets. Mm-hmm. So he heard the stories of the devastation and the pain that the working families across Los Angeles are feeling, to send a message to him that he needs to fight hard and on this committee and fight hard in Congress to represent the people of Los Angeles that are really suffering right now, and fight hard for the best economy, the best budget that will put money back in schools, back in firehouses, and restore jobs to the U.S.
And there are many cities across the country similar to L.A. I want to turn to Christy Setzer with U.S. Chamber Watch. I mentioned how the U.S. Chamber of Commerce has been offering solutions to the economic crisis that mirror what President Obama and many members of Congress are saying, which is simply focusing on tax breaks. But they go further in supporting free trade bills and openly supporting outsourcing. There was an interesting prescription by Republican candidate for President John Huntsman, who has called for Made in America to mean something again. This is reported by the Boston Globe yesterday, and he blamed the government for jobs going overseas. But he's a former executive of a company that bragged about employing more people in China and India than in North America. So even government officials have, it seems, been much more interested in outsourcing than job creation here in the United States, even if their rhetoric speaks otherwise, Chris.
Right. And that actually speaks exactly to some of the disingenuousness of the Chamber's plan yesterday. I mean, this is a group that they'd said they were holding this speech to lay out their plan for job creation. But in fact, in the past, if you've listened to the Chamber's rhetoric, they've flat out acknowledged that they don't know how to create jobs. So this is a group, obviously, that, you know, here in D.C., they have on their building, which is a huge, you know, headquarters right by the White House. They have this enormous building-sized banner that says J-O-B-S, jobs, all the way across. Hmm. But there have been a couple of funny key moments that when leaders of the chamber have been asked, how do you create jobs, they've been utterly stumped. So back in January, Tom Donahue was asked at their, you know, sort of State of the Chamber annual speech, you know, what should corporate America do to create jobs again? He was utterly stumped. He finally, you know, recovers a bit and says, well, corporations should provide a reasonable return to their investors. This is not exactly, you know, sort of the answer I think that, you know, most people, especially people who are unemployed, you know, want to hear. And it wasn't a one-time answer either. You know, just recently, just this past month, Martin Regalia, who's their chief economist, was asked the same thing. You know, what can government do? What can corporate America do, you know, to create jobs? And he sort of said the same thing. You know, there's not much government can do now. They should just promote these, you know, pro-growth policies. We should wait to get the economy into a state where it can better repair itself. You know, in other words, I don't know, was basically what he was saying. And then, you know, again, yesterday, Donahue said essentially the same thing again, where he said, you know, this is in typical Donahue fashion, over-the-top bombast. He said, quote, if you want a miracle, go to church, talking about, you know, how the economy is going to recover. So, you know, so it's not surprising that the policies that this group is are advocating for are not actually ones that do much to create jobs, because it's pretty clear that that's just not how they think.
I want to turn now to Kevin Miller. There are cities across the country and, of course, even in rural areas where unemployment is so high, as Mike was sharing. And the private sector, at least as represented by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, seems to have no solutions. But the city of, or was it the county of San Francisco, did something quite interesting in 2007. It enacted a mandatory paid sick leave law. What exactly does that require employers to do? And what effect did it have on the local economy there?
The law requires that employers provide some amount of time that can be used for sick leave, so without notice, like vacation would be used. It applies to both small and large businesses. There is a smaller amount of time required for small businesses than for large businesses. But all employees in San Francisco at this time are now required to receive sick days from their employers after a certain amount of employment. And at this time, it's been apparent that there's been no negative impact anyway on employment in San Francisco from this law. The overall employment numbers show clearly that there has been, if anything, that San Francisco has been more competitive in terms of employment growth than the surrounding counties.
So if people fall sick and they do get paid sick leave, they tend to actually take those days off, enabling them to recover faster. In the meantime, do companies essentially have to pay other employees to step in for them, which leads to this kind of healthier economy, you think?
Well, I think that it varies from industry to industry and position to position.
Mm-hmm.
Some positions clearly need a replacement. An airline pilot, a bus driver, a security guard, you'll need a replacement for those positions. And the kinds of people who didn't previously have sick leave are people who have lower incomes, people in service positions, like food workers and hotel workers. And so these are the people who are really benefiting the most from the law.
I want to turn back to Mike Garcia. At the Kitchen Table Summit that you moderated here in L.A. this week, what were some solutions that ordinary residents would like to see enacted? What did they want their member of Congress, Javier Becerra, and other members of Congress to do, which, you know, we're not really seeing beyond the kinds of things that, for example, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce is offering?
Well, first of all, the people in the audience realize that the real problem in this country is just an abuse of power by corporate America, and that the corporate executives have been paying themselves record amounts of salaries and bonuses. 1% of the highest paid individuals in the U.S. now account for 25% of our income. It's up from 10% just a decade ago. They've invested heavily in politics to control the political agenda so that to detour taxes away from them, continue their tax breaks, and prevent any more taxes.
And just to add to that, there was a report just this week that the CEOs of 25 firms paid more, got more pay than their firms paid in taxes. So individuals got more paid than their entire corporations paid in taxes to the government.
Exactly. More concretely, people want jobs. These corporations are sitting on over $2 trillion of cash. Apple Computer alone is sitting on more cash than the United States government. They can't and have the money to invest in jobs. If they can't pay more of their fair share in taxes to help relieve the pain and agony of the people that are suffering from closed schools, closed firehouses, shut down of public services and healthcare services, they can at least take that $2 trillion and invest it in job creation and put these people back to work. Some of the specific ideas we've talked about is investing in surface transportation infrastructure mm-hmm. projects that will put people back to work.
So like a public works project.
Public works projects, mm-hmm. building bridges, restoring bridges and roads to quality standards and put people back to work. Job training programs for the unemployed. Let's be creative. Let's think of what kind of jobs we can create for the unemployed and put them in training projects and programs that will help prepare them for those jobs that we open up. And let's fix our schools. We can invest in our schools, and the dilapidated the conditions of the schools now can be fixed. That's a good investment of infrastructure that could create jobs. The corporations can invest more. They can pay more of their fair share. That allows the government to invest in job creation for the poorest, most suffering communities across the country.
So the only way to get the private sector to do what we want it to do is to have our representatives in government make them do it, right? Either from getting more money in the treasury through taxes to fund public jobs, or to have the government create some ways for the private sector to actually create more jobs. But how do you force a corporation to create more jobs?
Well, our campaign, Good Jobs LA, believes that the best way to get the attention of the politicians and the corporations alike is to put a lot of people out on the streets, to show the anger, to show the despair, to show the absolute necessity to create jobs and create jobs now. America is going downhill. It's being heisted by corporate America and their abuse of political power. We need to put the power of the people back to work. We're thinking of organizing mass demonstrations and demonstrations on bridges and outside airports and ports and connecting with our community, building our community ally base up, and continue to knock on those doors and organize a movement that the politicians and corporations will listen to.
My guest is Mike Garcia. He is a president of SEIU USWW, or United Service Workers West. He moderated this week's Kitchen Table Summit organized by Good Jobs LA. I want to turn back to Christy Setzer. She's a spokesperson and senior advisor of U.S. Chamber Watch. Christy, during the debt ceiling debate, when there were this battle over raising the debt ceiling and trying to reduce the deficit, which ended up targeting social essential services like Medicare, et cetera, that people who in this weak economy are more and more reliant on. What did the U.S. Chamber of Commerce have to say about that particular debate?
You know, well, this is one of those cases in which they actually were in, you know, the right place. They wanted, you know, us to raise the debt ceiling. However, they also were in an uncomfortable position because they'd supported a lot of these Tea Party members who were calling to, you know, let the economy go into default and, you know, not to raise the debt ceiling. So what they ended up doing was basically remaining silent. They did send a letter to Congress, but they did no real lobbying on it. It just essentially was nothing like the effort that they put forth when they actually really, you know, care about an issue, which is, you know, for example, the $86 million that they spent to kill healthcare reform, or the, you know, tens of millions that they spent to kill Wall Street reform, which is an ongoing effort with them, but, and, you know, to kill the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. You know, on this issue, raising the debt ceiling, something that, you know, economists were saying was going to, you know, collapse our economy, essentially, you know, the biggest issue facing big business and corporate America since, frankly, the last time they helped collapse our economy a few years ago, and they remained utterly silent. It was stunning.
And Christy, remind our listeners what the power of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce is in Washington in terms of lobbying influence, which is why it's useful to even track what they do.
Yeah, they are the largest lobbying organization in the country.
And so... the largest lobby organization in the country is the one pushing for outsourcing jobs overseas.
That's correct, yes.
Well, it's certainly tough for those of us with no money to, or less money to compete with that. I'm going to turn back to Kevin Miller, who is the research associate with Institute for Women's Policy Research. Kevin, a couple of questions. One, are there other places aside from, say, Denver, Colorado, that are looking to pass copycat legislation to San Francisco's mandatory paid sick leave? And is addressing issues like paid sick leave that can improve the economy, help job growth, the best place to do that? Is that at the local level?
Well, right now, this is a national movement. There are campaigns active in a number of states and cities around the country. Currently, there are campaigns active, as you said, in Denver, Colorado, but also in Seattle. The most recent passage of a bill was in the state of Connecticut, which was the first state to pass such a bill. I think there are also people pushing for this sort of legislation on the federal level, but I think at this point Congress is seen as being unsympathetic to this issue, especially compared to some local and state groups and legislatures. So New York City has had a very strong and active campaign. The state of California has as well. So there really are a wide number of an array of campaigns at a number of levels right now.
And so those are happening from the local to the state level. Is there anything at the federal level to mandate paid sick leave?
Yes, there's been a law proposed for several years running now called the Healthy Families Act, which was initially introduced by Senator Kennedy. Currently, its primary House sponsor is Rosa DeLauro from Connecticut. And so there are, again, advocates working on that at the federal level. But I think most people feel at this time that city councils and state and local referenda are frequently the most feasible way to get this passed.
And just draw the line for us. How does paid sick leave, something that doesn't necessarily sound like it's directly related to job growth, how does that hold corporations and private employers accountable when it comes to employing people? Because there's one thing to want jobs. It's another thing to actually want decent, quality, good jobs.
Yes, and these laws, like San Francisco's and like the new law in Connecticut, have a lot to do with job security and keeping the jobs that people have. And many people's jobs who lack any kind of paid leave or job protection from missing work, getting sick or having a child get sick can mean losing one's job completely. So these laws really help cement and secure jobs for people, the jobs people already have that they can't afford to lose in this economy.
I want to turn back to Mike Garcia. The organization that organized the Kitchen Table Summit that you moderated is called Good Jobs LA. So I know you're also in favor of not just any job, but good jobs. Before the summit, I understand there was a march on an ExxonMobil gas station. You referred to needing to put more people out on the streets to pressure corporations, to shame them, if you will. What's next after this Kitchen Table Summit here locally for people to get involved with?
Well, we're looking for opportunities to expose the abuse of wealth and power in this country by corporate America, to put the target squarely on corporate America's back for A, destroying the economy, and B, refusing to accept responsibility to reinvest in the communities hit hardest by the recession and create good jobs, and refusing to pay their fair share into the federal government so people have the appropriate education and services they deserve. So we're looking for opportunities to put people on the streets. We're looking at marching on bridges. We're looking at continue the marches and the demonstrations outside ExxonMobil. We're looking at any opportunities we can to expose the abuse of power and put that target on the back, squarely on the back of the corporate America. So there's specific activities and marches we'll be focused on and activating people and moving them into action.
And what defines a good job here in Los Angeles?
Well, probably that question has to be a job that allows an individual to provide for their family with health care, family health care for their families, and respect and dignity on the job. Obviously, the best avenue for that is create more jobs that are unionized. And that's an issue that has to be a core fabric of the recovery plan, because unions need to be able to organize more workers into their membership. So
And are there clear correlations between better jobs and union jobs?
Absolutely. Union jobs provide for all the things I just mentioned. But the problem is over the last several decades, corporations have destroyed unions, and we're now down to less than 7% in the private sector. I think people know that they've been involved in a union drive that corporations viciously attack and smash the workers' will to organize unions. The result of that is a decline in the labor movement. We need a free and active, vibrant labor movement. But as organizers, it's our jobs to go out and talk to these workers and move them into campaigns that bring them into unions.
I want to turn back to Christy Setzer. Let's focus now on President Obama. I had mentioned that he's going to be unveiling a jobs plan next week. He has requested an address to a joint session of Congress, which is something that doesn't happen very often. Usually it's the State of the Union address. And it's going to be happening next Thursday. He's sort of hinted a little bit at what's going to be in store. And it might be there might be a public works component. The president has often talked about infrastructure rebuilding, yet he has caved into Republican pressures to reduce the deficit, resulting in thousands of government jobs being lost. What do you make of President Obama? Is he feeling the heat enough on the desire for job creation, or is he following the direction, the lead of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce?
No, I mean, I think there's no doubt that he's feeling the heat on the need to come up with a jobs plan. I think the question is whether that plan looks more like something that, as you said, the chamber and the Republican Party would put out, or something that, you know, more Democrats are calling for. The issue of infrastructure is an interesting one, because it's one where, at least on the surface, it seems like one where both parties can agree. The AFL-CIO has partnered with the U.S. Chamber on infrastructure issues. But yet again, with the chamber, this is one of those issues, much like the debt ceiling, where they talk a good talk, but they've not actually put their full muscle into it. So, I do think you're going to see the president, focus on infrastructure spending. I don't think that – I think that invariably you're also going to see him play into some, you know, Republican calls to reduce the deficit, and whether or not that's enough to, you know, pacify – Democrats and progressives, I'm just not sure.
Kevin Miller, do you see the president and even Democrats showing enough support for federal efforts to keep jobs secure and good, like the bill, the Healthy Families Bill that you mentioned? Has President Obama ever taken a position on that bill or others like it?
I believe the Obama administration actually has taken a position in favor of the Healthy Families Act at the federal level. I believe the Department of Labor came out and endorsed that at a hearing. So there has been some action by the president's administration, and certainly by many members of Congress on this issue. I think they're worried about the amount of business opposition from groups like the chamber, but there's a lot of good polling data and job and economic data that show that not only do workers need job protection for things like sick leave, but that these sorts of proposals are quite popular. Polling data show that that most voters, including even a majority of Republicans, but especially large majorities of Democrats and Independents, believe that these sorts of laws are a good idea and that that workers should have the right to take a sick day.
And, you know, aside from the issue of paid sick leave, there are so many other aspects to civil society that result in economic security for families. This week, there was a report about how child care in the United States has become so expensive that it rivals college tuition. And you've written for the Institute for Women's Policy Research about childcare access. Are those other aspects of economics that drain the economics off and the finances of ordinary families, are those also being addressed at all? Some people, you know, have to spend the second highest expenditure they have after their mortgage is childcare.
Absolutely. I think especially working class Americans simply have, you know, a limited amount of money, a limited amount of resources to expend on all of these problems, the need for sick leave, the need for child care. And absolutely, there are advocates working on these issues. But in general, the United States simply lacks the safety net that, for instance, Western European countries have. There's less access to childcare, and it's more expensive. There's no legal right to miss work when you're ill. There's no paid maternity leave, which, of course, particularly impacts women. But in the current environment, more and more men would like to be able to take paid leave off to spend with their children. And in the United States, there's simply no legal right to these sorts of supports.
Well, if one is a member of a union, it's generally you're more likely to get parental leave as part of your contract. I want to ask all three of my guests to give out contact information as we wrap up our discussion on jobs and job creation, and specifically the creation of good jobs and the creation of an environment where good jobs can exist. Mike Garcia, where can listeners find out more about Good Jobs LA as well as SEIU USWW?
Yes, they can contact our office and leave a message, and we'll transfer the information to Good Jobs LA. And my number is 213-798-6885.
That's 213-798-6885, and we'll post that on our website, uprisingradio.org, later today as well. Christy Setzer, give us the information for the U.S. Chamber Watch, and also maybe what are some new projects that you're working on. And I understand, of course, U.S. Chamber Watch has come under a lot of scrutiny for the work that you're doing, which we had actually covered on our program.
So you can find out a lot of information about all the great work that U.S. Chamber Watch is doing on our website, which is www.fixtheuschamber.org. We are going to be continuing, obviously, to take on the Chamber both on sort of their war on regulations, and then as we move into the 2012 election cycle, we'll again be talking about the increased role that they'll play in the wake of Citizens United, and the rise of, you know, third-party money groups. So definitely look for those issues on our website and in the press.
FixTheUSChamber.org. Well, finally, Kevin Miller, the Institute for Women's Policy Research does a lot of research around women in the workplace. Can you give out a website for your organization?
Sure. As you said, we work on a wide variety of issues that impact women and especially low-income workers, and you can find out more about the issues we work on at our website at www.iwpr.org.
That's iwpr.org. Kevin Miller, Christy Setzer, Mike Garcia. I want to thank the three of you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Kevin Miller is a senior research associate with Institute for Women's Policy Research. Again, the website, iwpr.org. Mike Garcia, president of SEIU USWW. He moderated this week's Kitchen Table Summit organized by Good Jobs LA. And also Christy Setzer, spokesperson with and senior advisor of U.S. Chamber Watch. Their website is fixtheuschamber.org. And by the way, Good Jobs LA's website is goodjobsla.org. We've been talking about job creation, the increasing push around job creation. Commission. And, of course, we'll cover the president's speech next week. This is Uprising. Up next, this week's Black Agenda Report with Bruce Dixon. And then a short music break followed by our coverage of the Keystone XL pipeline protests happening in Washington, D.C. More than 700 people have been arrested. We'll talk to one of the people arrested. Stay tuned.
Become a member of KPFK today. Go to kpfk.org and click on Pledge Support.
Hi, this is Kristen. I'm a KPFK volunteer. To get involved at your favorite radio station, contact our volunteer coordinator, Jesse, by emailing volunteer@kpfk.org or call 818-985-2711.
Bruce Dixon is the managing editor of the Black Agenda Report. He filed today's commentary on the upcoming 40th anniversary of the Attica Uprising.
Forty years ago this week, inmates in upstate New York's Attica prison took their lives and destinies into their own hands. The prison, designed for 1,200 inmates at the time, housed nearly double that number, and inmates were limited to one shower per week and a single roll of toilet paper per month. Arbitrary beatings and religious discrimination against Muslim inmates were common. "We are men," an inmate spokesperson declared, "and not beasts to be driven as such." Their demands were the mostly unremarkable stuff every human deserves: decent and healthful food, the ability to observe the dietary restrictions of some of their religions. They demanded warm clothing and bedding for the cold upstate winters, and serious efforts to exterminate their vermin-infested quarters. The inmates wanted books, self-improvement and educational programs to better prepare them to make a difference on the outside. They demanded medical care, transparency and justice in parole and prison administrative decisions, and an end to religious and racial discrimination inside the prison, along with the replacement of the prison warden. They requested the presence of Black Panther Party Chairman Bobby Seale and the Nation of Islam's Louis Farrakhan. Crack movement attorneys from around the country also flew in to upstate New York. It was 1971, and the whole world was watching. For 4 days, they negotiated with the office of New York Governor Nelson Rockefeller until the governor, eyeing a possible 1972 Republican presidential or vice presidential nomination, shut the talks down and ordered a murderous assault upon the prison. Correctional officers and New York State Police poured a hail of gunfire into the prison, killing at least 39 people, including 10 correctional officers and civilian prison employees. After the retaking of the prison, they engaged in a savage orgy of reprisal beatings of the surviving inmates, and dozens of murder charges were filed against the survivors. Juries eventually acquitted all the inmates of all murder charges, and although no police officers or state officials were ever indicted, the state eventually paid out tens of millions in settlements to surviving inmates and to the families of murdered correctional officers. 40 years on, both much and little have changed. Muslims in U.S. prisons still experience vicious discrimination. Inmates nationwide are still denied adequate food and medical care, and the secrecy of prison administration continues to license arbitrary brutality on the part of correctional officers. The lone, lowly corporal convicted of torture at Abu Ghraib was in civilian life a Pennsylvania prison guard. But since the days of Attica, the U.S. prison population has increased more than sixfold. We have become the world's first true prison state, with nearly 70% of prisoners coming from the nation's brown and black one quarter. Imprisonment has become more and more the fate of the lowest income blacks as well. A college-educated black man today stands one-third the chance of incarceration as he did in 1970, while today's black male high school dropout is 7 times more likely to be jailed than his dropout uncle in 1970. We've come a long way since Attica, and not all of it the way we'd like. The lasting lessons of Attica are that little will change until current and former inmates, many times more numerous today than in 1971, once again take their destinies into their own hands, declare themselves men, not beasts, and organize themselves and their communities in a political fight to roll back the prison state in their lifetimes. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Bruce Dixon.
Visit www.blackagendareport.com for more information.
That I could work for you, someone else's hand. Oh, I wish that I could work for you, someone else's hand. To be behind the counter of a bookstore that you're in, charge you $7 for a crossword and a pen. You would leave and not look back again. Even hardened criminals, they get a second chance. Oh, I wish that I could work for you with someone else's hand.
Disguised to Someone Else by Chicago-based independent musician Joe Pug. More online at joepugmusic.com. That's J-O-E-P-U-G music.com. This is Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar. Republican Governor of Nebraska Dave Heineman yesterday spoke out against the proposed 1,700-mile Keystone XL pipeline. In a letter to President Obama, Heineman made the case that the pipeline would threaten a vital Nebraska aquifer and the state's economy. This is a high-profile boost for the droves of protesters who have spent 13 days staging sit-ins against the pipeline in front of the White House, getting only sporadic media attention. Over 700 people have been arrested since August 20th for participating in the nonviolent direct action, the culmination of months of organizing against TransCanada's tar sands pipeline. So far, the president's reaction to the clamor on his front lawn has been silence. In the last week and a half, Obama has issued statements on Hurricane Irene, on the election of new Japanese Prime Minister Yoshihiko Noda, on the Muslim holiday of Eid al-Fitr, and on events in Mexico. On the thousands of Americans demanding a stop to the pipeline project, he has said nothing. Likewise, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, whose State Department is tasked with approving the project's permit, has not even publicly acknowledged the nearly two-week action in Washington, D.C. During an August 26th press conference, a spokesperson on the department's anticipated final environmental impact statement said the report's summary findings state, quote, there would be no significant impacts to most resources along the proposed pipeline corridor. Of the many that would disagree with this assessment is NASA climate scientist James Hansen, who joined the protests and was arrested on Monday. Last week, Hansen called on the president to show that he is not a, quote, hopeless addict to oil, and said approving the pipeline would be game over for the health of the planet. The protests have also drawn folks better known for their activism in other areas, including Army veteran and LGBT activist Dan Choi and Just Foreign Policy's Robert Naiman. The last day of action is this Saturday, September 3rd. We go now live to Washington, D.C. to speak with Brant Olson. He is the Tar Sands Campaign Director of the Rainforest Action Network. He was arrested at the White House yesterday. Welcome to Uprising, Brant.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Well, describe the scene right now. I understand that 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, which is 8 a.m. here, right as this program got started, is when the sit-in happened and happens every single day that does result in arrests. Describe the scene that you're seeing right now.
That's right. So right now I'm looking at the White House, and just opposite the street in front of me is 130 individuals that are lined up on the sidewalk sitting in, and the police have just begun to arrest them. So this is day 13 now of the protests. I went through the same process yesterday, and it's just an incredibly empowering and inspiring moment to see them walk, you know, two by two up to the fence, sit down, and stand for what they believe in.
So there have been a number of high-profile people. I mentioned James Hansen, but also actress and activist Daryl Hannah, and, of course, Bill McKibben, founder of 350.org. Tell us about some of the folks like yourself who've been arrested. They seem to include people both well-known and not.
Absolutely. Every, you know, political stripe across the political spectrum. You know, some of the most inspiring stories that I've heard have come from the landowners themselves that are going to be impacted by this pipeline. Met a woman named Julie this afternoon who came here of her own accord, had not been in contact with any group previously, but had heard about the protests through the media. She lives on a 500-acre ranch in Texas, which TransCanada is now trying to condemn in order to build their pipeline. And she was brought to tears just by the number of people of all ages that are out here supporting the fight against this pipeline.
And how are the arrests happening? What exactly are the activists doing? You said they were walking two by two to the fence. How are they being treated by the police? Are there media there present, at least independent media, if not mainstream media?
Yeah, you know, so there's a group of probably an equal number, 150 or so, that are here just supporting those that are in front of the White House. They've got a perimeter established around those that are sitting in. And they have it's almost a routine by this. So there's probably a dozen police officers that have set up a tent. There's a bus waiting to take away the protesters, and their supporters here on the other side of the barricades cheering them on. You know, certainly a smattering of media. Jeff Fox, the director of Gasland, is here today. He's actually being arrested now.
Wow.
And was conducting interviews prior to sitting in at the White House. He's got his camera with him, I think, taking some footage as he gets arrested. Also, plenty of independent media. We've been doing our own media at tarsandsaction.org. Folks can check out stories from a lot of the participants that have been taking part and learn more about how to participate. There's certainly still time.
Well, I want to play for you and our listeners an excerpt of Dan Choi, who is the well-known LGBT activist, U.S. Army veteran. He has been part of these protests, and this action at the White House is drawing such a broad coalition of people, not just the sort of usual suspects in the environmental movement, but people like Dan Choi as well.
I've spent my time in activism fighting for gay rights and for equality. And I now recognize, after 2 years of fighting, that we can be legally equal, and we certainly will fight for our future generations, but I want them to be able to live equally in a clean world, in a place where we have sustainable environment and that the skies are still blue and people can still breathe. So I don't see any difference or conflict between my being a gay rights activist and coming here to try and educate people about this tar sands action and this pipeline that's going to destroy our environment as well as the environment of other countries.
Dan Choi is a well-known LGBT activist, a U.S. Army veteran. He is joined by a number of people, hundreds of people, over this two-week-long protest that culminates on Saturday. Over 700 people have been arrested. Brant Olson is my guest. He's the Tar Sands campaign director of the Rainforest Action Network, one of the more than 700 people arrested. Brant, why has this particular action attracted so many people across such a large spectrum?
You know, I in talking with people out here, I just think that people are so disappointed in this president, you know, and I think, you know, I certainly had a lot of hope. I voted for Obama. I cried the night that I, you know, heard his acceptance speech in Chicago. I was so encouraged when I heard him address the climate meeting that was called by Governor Schwarzenegger in California soon before he was elected. You know, he has made such broad promises to tackle the climate issue. And time again, he hasn't fulfilled those promises. And I think that so many of us that elected President Obama are so disappointed that this was really just an inflection point. You know, it was a chance to really come and express that disappointment. And it's really pulling in all stripes. We have an indigenous delegation that's down from Canada even taking action tomorrow. So even beyond those of us who are in the United States and voted for President Obama, it really crosses international boundaries. There's all kinds of people out here.
And remind our listeners of the context of what we're talking about. Why did James Hansen call it game over for the planet if this project is approved? It's just one project, but is it that the scope is so big that even beyond the leaks along the pipeline that are inevitable to occur, if the oil that this pipeline will deliver is burned, we're talking about a giant release of CO2 into the atmosphere. It sort of represents all of the carbon dioxide and greenhouse gases that haven't yet been released into the atmosphere that will push the Earth over the tipping point. Is that it?
That's right. I mean, I've taken several trips up to the tar sands, and it's an incredible thing to see. I mean, it's literally strip mining for oil on a scale that's almost hard to comprehend. You really have to get into a helicopter to see it, and it stretches out to every point on the horizon. When you're strip mining for oil, you can be pretty sure that you're at the bottom of the barrel in terms of world oil supply. And so, you know, Dr. Hansen, I think, has stated it very well. He said that this is the second largest pool of carbon on the planet, and if we burn it all, it's essentially game over. Bill McKibben has said that the Keystone XL pipeline is a 1,700-mile fuse to the second largest carbon bomb on the planet, and it's really true. You know, it's unfortunate that the world oil industry has doubled down in this way on pursuing, you know, ever dirtier sources of crude oil, when what we should be doing is spending the $7 or $8 billion that this pipeline is going to cost on transitions towards a more sustainable transportation fleet, electrified transportation, public transportation, so many things that can be done instead of just chasing that last drop of oil in the tar sands. Mm-hmm.
Now, the State Department, as I'd mentioned, is basically where the approval for the permit for this project is going to be happening. But last Friday, a spokesperson concluded and said publicly that there would be no significant impacts to most resources along the proposed pipeline corridor. Is that an indication that the State Department is going to approve this permit?
Well, the State Department's role is essentially over at this point. They've done the environmental impact assessment, and now it's really squarely on the president's desk. The next step in the process is going to be a national interest determination, and that's the point when the president can really step in to stop this thing. I mean, the State Department, I think there's a couple of problems there that need to be recognized. First is just that they are not a competent agency to evaluate the environmental impact of an oil pipeline.
But they're just brought in because it's a deal with Canada, a foreign country.
Right. It's sort of a curiosity of national policy that the State Department has to get involved because of the national boundary. But really, you know, the institutional expertise in this country lies in the EPA. And the EPA has been very straightforward about their concerns on this project. Many of those concerns have yet to be addressed, especially in terms of the impacts on environmental justice communities in the Gulf Coast region that are going to have to deal with the increased air pollution that this pipeline would mean, fails to address some of the alternatives that would be available to this pipeline that would avoid impacts on the Ogallala Aquifer, which is the largest freshwater aquifer in the country. The other issue with the State Department, though, that I think is extremely important, is that they've really been politically compromised. I mean, the former campaign manager for Hillary Clinton is the lead lobbyist for TransCanada on this project. So, you know, we really feel that President Obama needs to intervene. This has not been an adequate process and needs to stop this thing and support the people in Nebraska and the governor that has come out to say, no, we need to put the brakes on and reevaluate.
Well, on that issue, how much of a boost has the movement against the pipeline received from the statement by the Republican governor of Nebraska, who has asked President Obama to stop the pipeline? It seems as though so far he might be the only high-profile conservative to do so.
It was a huge boost. And, you know, I think it's a testament to the power of grassroots organizing. And last month, there was 500 people in Nebraska and Omaha that surrounded the governor's mansion and shone flashlights at dusk on his house to try and expose some of the issues about this issue. There are some of the concerns about this pipeline. And lo and behold, he comes around and actually comes to support their position. Just today, we learned of a group out in Seattle that went into the Obama campaign's regional headquarters there to deliver their concerns. And each of those actions make a huge difference. You know, it's certainly the 800 people that are here in Washington, D.C., but it's also going to take action around this country to really turn this thing around. And I can't encourage people enough, you know, get one or two friends together, visit your local campaign headquarters, call your congressman. Now is the time really to turn this thing around.
My guest is Brant Olson, tar sands campaign director of the Rainforest Action Network, joining us live from Washington, D.C., where the demonstrations against the XL tar sands pipeline have been going into their second week. The two-week campaign ends this Saturday. More than 700 people, including Brant, have been arrested. Now, there is an argument in favor of this pipeline that implies it's a matter of national security because it decreases our dependence on Middle East oil to have Canadian oil through the tar sands. That's Canada somehow, you know, of course, friendlier than Saudi Arabia. I want to play for you and our listeners a clip of an ad by the name of Ethical Oil, as if there is such a thing, that has been running on Oprah's TV network.
Fact. Last year, we bought over 400 million barrels of oil from Saudi Arabia. We bankrolled a state that doesn't allow women to drive, doesn't allow them to leave their homes or work without their male guardian's permission, and a state where a woman's testimony only counts for a half of a man's. Why are we paying their bills and funding their oppression? Today, there's a better way. Ethical oil from Canada's oil sands. Ethical oil. A choice we have to make.
Brant Olson, we are funding women's oppression and so in Saudi Arabia through buying Saudi oil, so why not Canadian oil? How do you respond?
You know, it's absolutely true that oil proceeds are financing a lot of despicable things on this planet. And the problem is that building the Keystone Pipeline isn't going to make any of that situation better. Even if we're to increase imports from Canada, that's not going to do anything to decrease imports from the Middle East. It just doesn't work that way. And in fact, TransCanada's own research that they filed with the State Department in their application proves exactly that. I mean, what's happening is that this is really an export pipeline. So this oil that's coming down from the tar sands in Canada really isn't even going to end up in American gas tanks. It's going to be refined into diesel and other products in the Gulf Coast region that is going to be then exported to international markets. And the companies in that region, the refiners in that region, have made that very clear in their presentations to investors. Now, when they're talking to the American public, on the other hand, they enroll people that are behind that ad, which are these Conservative Party hucksters from Canada who are really just trying to be sensationalist and send misinformation out to the American public. And unfortunately, they've gained quite a lot of attention for doing so.
Well, they really care about women's rights in Saudi Arabia, it seems.
it's really a joke. Actually, the guy who is behind that ad in particular, Alakon Belshi, he's a conservative party consultant in Canada. He was here today at the White House. He doesn't give a damn about Saudi women. I confronted him on it. I said, why not just ban imports from Saudi Arabia if you're so concerned? Oh, no, we can't do that. We're very concerned about the free market, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. This is really just a game that they're playing to try and gain some attention and distract people from the real issue here, which is our addiction to oil. It's reducing demand for oil is really what's going to stop oil proceeds funding things like, you know, terrorism and the maltreatment of women.
Well, finally, Brant Olson, the media coverage that this action hasn't received is staggering. It's amazing that there are so many people who have sustained this action for so long right in front of the White House. If there were major media coverage, you might expect the president to actually respond. He hasn't. There's been silence. I'm wondering what sort of media coverage can you imagine there would be if there had been Tea Party activists who had been on the lawn in front of the White House making their various demands to President Obama, getting arrested by the hundreds. Would we be seeing this on the front pages of the New York Times and other media institutions?
Yeah, I think so, absolutely. And, you know, it's a bit of a head-scratcher. I've been in a lot of those conversations with journalists, and, you know, unless we can pull out celebrity or unless we can...
But you have. I mean, Daryl Hannah, James Hansen, you know, there have been a lot of well-known people.
Right, and the once or twice that we've sort of shown up on the national media's radar is when Daryl Hannah was here. And I love Daryl Hannah. She's a great advocate for the oil sands. But it's a sad commentary on our media to think that, you know, it takes this this sort of celebrity draw in order to really get a debate going. And, you know, she's been a great advocate for our cause. It should take more than celebrity to attract attention to your cause. I mean, we have 800 people out here that have taken time out of their lives and been willing to be arrested for this cause. We have experts that can really dig into the issues in a way that's you know, very deep, and the media really doesn't care. You know, we've been doing this for almost 2 weeks, talking to journalists the whole way along, and not once have we been asked for even so much of the fact sheet from the national media. So it's, you know, it's a sad state of affairs. And of course, we don't have the advertising dollars on our side. We don't have the
you don't have the Koch brothers.
We don't have the Koch brothers on our side. So
give out the website for the Rainforest Action Network as we wrap up.
Sure, you can visit our website at ran.org/tarsands if you want to know more about this issue in particular. And another good website has all kinds of factual information is dirtyoilsands.org. And thanks so much for having me on today.
Thank you so much, Brent Olson. He's the Tar Sands campaign director of the Rainforest Action Network. He was arrested at the White House on Wednesday. For Sonali, subversive thought for the day, Dorothy Day once said, "No one has a right to sit down and feel hopeless. There's too much work to do." That's Dorothy Day. That's Sonali, subversive thought for the day. You've been listening to Uprising. Martina Steiner is our assistant producer. Chris Bennett is our music curator. Teddy Robinson is our engineer. Our website is uprisingradio.org, where you can listen to the show online, find links, local events, and other information we mention on the air, as well as rate all of our interviews and leave comments. I'm your host and producer, Sonali Kolhatkar. Thanks so much for listening. I'll see you tomorrow at 8:00.